This is the Living Legacy Project interview with John Fall on November 5th, 2013. And John, thank you for joining me here today at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. I'd like to ask you first, what inspired you to want to be a photographer?
I guess it was from my mother, who was a German immigrant, and she had done a lot of photography as a youth. It was something that people did in Germany, and not necessarily in the United States that much. And so she actually came over, and her first job in this country was to work in the kitchen at Macy's, New York City, Herald Square. And she told me she actually won a contest of the staff at Macy's for her photography. So I do have somebody in my past that, but anyway, so she gave me the proverbial baby brownie, and I started taking pictures almost immediately, and at first I sent them away to be processed, and I never, you know, had a darkroom or anything. I would just send them and wait for them to be processed. And a week later I would get my prints back. So it was a slow start, but it was a good start.
Where did you go to school after high school?
I went to Syracuse University for my undergraduate, and then later on also for my graduate. It was the art school as an undergraduate, so I had a really good education in the traditional arts, but it turns out I wasn't that great at it. So they were just starting a photo program, and I fled to the photo program and became very interested in photography. And I was lucky that there was a teacher there named Fred Demarest, who started the program and was extremely encouraging. He was not from the art tradition, he was from photojournalism. And the program was in the school of, at that time, called journalism. So I was able to not be influenced by anybody too much, because I sort of came at the arts from a photojournalistic point of view.
And you continued on at Syracuse University into your graduate program. Did you pursue photojournalism there as well?
No, I actually graduated and then undergraduate. And then I tried to work in photography in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I was the assistant for a fashion editorial type designer named Paul Elfenbein, who had a studio on, I forgot, Fifth Avenue, I think. And a job that I absolutely hated, but it taught me a lot about what I really didn't want to do. I guess I thought that I would learn a lot, and he was just not interested in that. He was just sort of cruel. But so then I was about to be drafted in the Army, and so I volunteered for the draft. This was after the Korean War and before the Vietnam War. So I volunteered for the draft and spent 2 years in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And then I went to California to see if I could pursue a career in Los Angeles or in San Francisco. And I landed a job very quickly at a place called Herbert Bruce Cross Studios, where I was became a printer, an assistant. And Herbert Bruce Cross was a very old-time photographer and had primarily architecture. He occasionally did people, but not very well. He was the type of person who would take group portraits, and they called him One Shot Harry and Herbie. And when I printed this group of people, I had to look out to see who blinked, whose eyes were closed, and I had to retouch it so that their eyes opened. And so they had this very ghoulish look to some of the people. But I learned a lot about printing and business, and primarily learned to love Los Angeles. And then I was still in contact with Fred Demarest at Syracuse, and he invited me to come back and become an assistant to, a photo assistant, and get my my master's degree. So I did that. And then eventually, I mean, my career was like a matter of seized opportunities. Things came along and I took them. And if I didn't like what I was doing, I would create more and different opportunities. But I really enjoyed that because I was did teaching, and I worked on a thesis in color. And by that time, Syracuse had the first color program for masters in the United States. And so I enrolled in that program. So I learned all about color photography, which in those days was not nearly as... It was much more limited than one could do now with color. But I just enjoyed that, being there. And as soon as I graduated, RIT asked me if I wanted to come and teach there in Rochester. And at first I thought, oh no, never. I want to, you know, I want to go to back to California. But by that time I was married to Bonnie Gordon, my wife, and we decided to go to Rochester where she could go get her master's at the school while I was teaching there. And so that was the next step. At RIT, I was teaching color and I was teaching basic photography. And so far, I wasn't really an artist, or I didn't consider myself an artist. I was a photographer and I just did what I could do. I did fashion and I did all kinds of different things, you know. But at RIT, which was in Rochester, New York, which had an enormously influential photography community at that time, I started making friends with people who were in the arts and had somewhat successful careers in photography. And so I decided, well, I'm going to get myself some of that. And I shared my office with Betty Hahn, who became a very influential artist, photographer, and with B. Nettles. And there were just a whole bunch of people in Rochester at that time who were starting to make breakout careers. And so that was some... more so than any having any guru type of influence. It was just the influence came from a number of people that I was working with and socializing with. So I taught at RIT for 14 years, and then I started really getting tired of teaching. The first 7 years were wonderful because I was learning how to teach, and that was great. And then the second 7 years got progressively worse because I knew how to teach, but I didn't. I just didn't want to repeat myself over and over again. And so, and my personal photography was getting more and more influential, and it's assumed more and more of my time. And after I started being able to sell my work and have a semi-career, I decided that I would quit and strike out on my own. Of course, I wouldn't recommend this to everybody, but you have to have health insurance, which everybody knows now. But since my wife was teaching here at Buffalo State College, her coverage covered both of us, and so I was able to contribute what I could to the family income without having to have health insurance on my own. So that's basically the plot line for most places that I've worked. And then I was totally on my own after that. My work was humming along, and it was I was selling work, so I kept doing it.
I'm glad you touched on your transition from more of a technical photographer into fine art, because that I was kind of getting that feeling as well as you started describing with your background before doing your master's program.
Yeah, I felt that was really, in retrospect, I felt it was really important, because, I mean, I guess now it wouldn't be so important because cameras do much more for you than they did at that time. But I was happy to do it. I worked with the view camera, and most of my early negatives are large negatives. And I was able, even now I can make wonderful digital prints from the negatives because the negatives were so large. I guess now I would have to have a very expensive camera to even achieve that quality. And it was very easy to me to make a trans to, because I taught color, I became quite proficient at it, and some of my students went on to also teach color, so that was one of the interesting things to watch.
And quite a gold star for you, too, to know that your teaching abilities was strong enough to influence others to go on and teach as well.
Oh, yeah. I recently had an exhibit in Rochester at the Contemporary Art Rocco, and they had this program. Once a year, they have a mentor, teacher, and student program. And so I invited, I think it was 12 of my former students to... who are all now teachers or somewhat professional, to submit just a tiny summary of their work. And that was extremely wonderful because they all came, and we had a great evening and a great panel discussion. And it was just a thrill to see those were my children. Yeah.
And they were all exhibiting fine artists at that point in there?
Yeah, actually. There was a fashion photographer amongst them. And, exactly. Yeah.
Could I ask you a little bit, you touched on it, of the current move into digital photography.
Uh-huh.
And could I ask you to speak a little bit about your experiences working in a much more analog format and sort of some of your insights with where photography is going or has gone into almost purely digital at this point?
Well, I hear that in teaching that, analog photography is coming back, that people are very interested in non-silver projects. And since a lot of the photography programs are in art schools and are sort of... offered to art students, that people want to do that. They want to go back to the basics of photography. But for me, I was always a little bit interested in digital. In fact, I did a couple of projects within the graphic arts department where I was probably one of the first people just to scan photographs and then use the scans to make dye transfer prints, because that was before there were digital cameras, or they were in the graphic arts. So I was always wishing for. I kept asking people, when do you think you can make digital photographs that look as sharp as analog photographs? And so as the years passed by, it became more and more possible to do that. And so I did, I finally, much more recently, have done a number of digital projects. I'm trying to think of, people who use it digital now and are successful, and turns out that they don't do the printing themselves. They just do it. They have somebody else do all the color corrections and all the fine points. So I actually love that aspect of photography, and I think that attracts a lot of people, is that you can do everything in a dark room, or you can, or on the computer yourself, rather than sending it out to a professional printer, because it opens a lot of opportunities to experiment with the medium.
I think it probably also gives you a much deeper understanding of your of the work that you're creating.
Well, it gives you an understanding of the possibilities of what you make, so that you learn to understand that there are 100 ways to make a print, and that you have to figure out which is the way that works best for you.
So can we talk a little bit about, as you moved into building a career in the arts, maybe after RIT when you were supporting yourself as a fine artist, can you talk about some of the themes or subject matter that you were interested in and what you explored in your fine art?
Sure. I was always interested in color. I was never very good at black and white. never learned how to make a good print in black and white, even though I thought I made great prints, and then people would laugh and point out the defects. And I was always interested in large negatives, sharp, very sharp images, and that were very descriptive. And my major interest was nature and different ways that I could interact with nature and actually make it more than just going out in the woods and finding things. And so I was able to come up with some ideas, of which the first serious group of photographs I did was the altered landscapes, which you have a print of here, and where I was able to sort of work with the landscape to achieve some kind of conceptual idea. Now, do you want me to talk about the picture now or later?
Good question. I mean, could you talk about sort of the whole series now and then maybe talk about that work later?
Yeah. Well, I discovered, I was always interested in optical illusions, and I found that I was able to place objects, string, tape, whatever, into the landscapes and have them appear as two-dimensional drawings on top of the surface of my colored print, although they were actually placed in the landscape. And so it worked. It was not a new idea to me that, you know, optical illusions were around since Leonardo da Vinci, but it was one of the things that I enjoyed doing in the landscape, and it permitted me to go and seek places all over the country that would lend themselves to these quote-unquote drawings that I did on top of the photographs. And I was, you know, at that time there were a number of conceptual, it was the beginnings of conceptual art as being a major force in the art world, and I always thought that those people who worked in that area, they were interested in the idea, but they didn't, the products were sort of charming and offhand, but I didn't find them as interesting as photographs. And so all my photographs were very sharp, and they were in color and well printed, and so that was in opposition to some of the artists at that time who just basically used a box camera to make black and white sharp and unsharp pictures, but which was valid, because that's, you know, that placed the interest of the viewer back into the mind of the artist, but I was interested in having the viewer enjoy the experience of the print. So I did probably about 150 pictures all over the country, from North Carolina, where the print is, that you have, and to California, back to, you know, I was always looking for a way to get back to California and to the West, because I just loved the West. the Western landscape, in a way, allowed me to do these drawings on the ground, so that I was on the East Coast. There are too many trees, so I had to do the drawings on the trees themselves. But out west, I could draw on the ground and have a further distances in the photograph.
That sounds like a fascinating project, though. It must have been a lot of fun.
It was. I did it almost entirely on my own. I would take a car and drive out to, say, Salt Lake City, Utah, and work in that area for 2 or 3 weeks. And then I would leave the car there in the garage and fly home and spend, you know, a month or so at home. And then in another season, I would fly back out and pick up the garage and pick up the car out of the garage and just drive on and then maybe go to California, leave the car in California for a while. So
that's a great idea.
Yeah, it was a lot cheaper than renting a car.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I just really enjoyed those days going, just driving around, getting ideas on the road. I seem to get my best ideas when I'm on the road and driving. And I was able to do a lot of work, sort of hoping and praying that my negatives were fine, because I never saw anything until I came home, which is one big difference that the digital process allows you to do. So sometimes I got home and was disappointed in things and others, but generally it worked out.
Do you think that the disappointment was intensified because of all the work you had to put in without knowing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I did know, because I used Polaroid, 4x5 Polaroid film, black and white film, to test prints. I knew that the composition was right and the exposure was right. But there's always the unforeseen light leak or bellows leak or whatever that happened.
What kind of camera were you using for the Altered Landscape series?
I was using a Horseman 4x5 field camera. It was a fairly small 4x5 that folded up, and you could carry it on your back and on the pack. And so I was able to move off the away from the parking lot and take it on hikes and mm-hmm. stuff like that. It was a good way of working, because I didn't have an assistant, and I didn't really want an assistant. It was I had assistants who helped me, but it was much more of a, it was difficult to explain to them exactly what I wanted, because I was working in three-dimensional space, and it was almost like four-dimensional space, and they never could figure out where I actually wanted them to place these items. And then the other thing is, when I haven't had an assistant, I was always worrying about their comfort and whether they were okay, and if they're hungry or they had to go to the bathroom or what. So I wasn't able to concentrate, whereas if I wasn't working alone, I was totally able to concentrate on the work at hand. And I would, you know, if I had to suffer, that was, you know, all in suffering for my art.
As a true artist does. That actually, you know, I spend so much of my time with Charles Birchfield's sketches and journals and reading and transcribing his journals, and it's very similar to how he worked within nature. He would just take a pack and drive somewhere off into the distance and then hike up into the woods and just, you know, stay there no matter how brutal the sun or the breeze or the rain was. But I don't think he ever conceptualized of having an assistant, you know.
Yeah, he probably would have loved photography, I think, because there are things that happen in photography that have that mystical quality that he was so fond of, the accidental.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of color, I wanted to ask you, Did you notice, like, when you were traveling around the country, photographing in all these different places, was sort of the different color tonalities of different regions something that influenced your work or that you were aware of? Or?
I was very much aware of the light and the atmosphere. And I loved the light at certain times of the day. The light in the desert was wonderful. And there are certain times of the day when it was brutal. And on the East Coast, you're much more aware of the clouds and the humidity and the moisture in the air and the softness. So much more the light than the color, although, you know, the color was... the desert colors are incredibly wonderful. So on the East Coast, it's... everything's green, but in the West, I was very much intrigued by what the colors were that I could find. It was all new to me, so I loved being out there.
What about winter here on the East Coast?
Yeah, that's when I went out. that's when I flew to my car. You too. Yeah, I don't do a lot of photography. Did not do a lot of photography in the winter. Mm-hmm. That's when I printed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did you, in your travels, go... And I have seen some of the Ultra Landscape series, but perhaps not all of them and not in depth. Did you ever go to sort of like the more Pacific Northwest? Did you go up north at all?
I did, yeah. My brother lives in the Northwest, in north of Seattle, and... I did some photography there. Mostly, that was a later project where I did picture windows and I drove around knocking on people's doors to let me come into their house and photograph through their picture window. My brother was very helpful in that because he lives in a county, Skagit County, where he knew everybody in the county. Because he worked in, I guess, for Head Start. So we would drive around, and I would say, oh, I'd like to photograph through that window, and he'd knock on the door and explain it. And I was able to have access to that, so it was very convenient.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. The other thing I did to have access for that project is, in Florida, I knew a woman who was a real estate agent, and so I hired her to take me around to all the houses that were for sale that she had a key to, and so that was another way of getting access to a lot of houses.
What was that project titled?
Picture Windows, and that was it was sort of a direct next step from the Altered Landscapes, because I wanted to take pictures of the landscape where the lines were already drawn. For example, all the mullions and different panes of the window and the cracks in the window, maybe the water moisture on the window or the stains on the window would interact with the landscape behind it. And also it was a way of working when it was raining, which was good, and some of the winter pictures as well. One of the windows I was just looking at recently was in a house in Rochester, and there was this enormous icicle in front of the window. And so, I mean, really big icicle, killer icicle.
Uh-huh.
And so I was able to photograph that with the city of Rochester behind it.
Sounds very evocative of the region.
Of the what?
Of the region, you know.
Yeah.
We've
oh,
all
yeah.
Seen
yeah.
Those
yeah.
Deadly.
Yeah. My winter pictures. So I only photograph in the winter, but I can be inside.
It's smart. It's very smart.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting too to see a series like that, perhaps after the financial collapse in 2008, where all of a sudden there's an incredible amount of foreclosures and
oh, right.
Vacant houses, you know, and some perhaps some of them left.
Actually, I have I know somebody in California who did several series on the collapse of the housing market in California.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sad. It was a great project.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to think of the progression of my work.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have brought the list because I think after the picture windows, I did a series of power places, and that was again involved a lot of travel. As I was driving around doing the picture windows and altered landscapes, I kept seeing these magnificent landscapes that were disrupted by power plants in the distance. In the West particularly, because you can see them from miles away, and you can see sometimes there's smoke from miles away as well. And so I did a project where it started out being all nuclear plants, Three Mile Island, some of the nuclear plants out west. But it also became a little wider in that I did hydroelectric plants, and I did geothermal plants, and just how the electricity is created. And they were sort of based on the early Hudson River school painters who painted these lovely landscapes with what they thought was a wonderful addition, the sign of progress, and had the power plants in the background with the smoke, and there's none of this, none of these issues about, you know, pollution or the environment or whatever. And I thought that was kind of a nice thing to work off of. So I did get a lot of flack because my pictures were so beautiful. People thought they were, why am I making pictures so beautiful of all these destructive nuclear plants? And I was trying to keep I was not that interested in the issue of making a political statement. And so people criticized that work for quite a bit. And then, of course, I thought the issue was so much bigger because you know, everybody was criticizing nuclear power, and yet they used it to run their toothbrushes in the morning. So, you know, it's sort of hypocritical.
Could I ask, would you say that the way you depicted these signs of electrical progress or power plants, would you say there was an element of the sublime to the way that you depicted them?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I actually thought of that in this, the sense, some of the images were used those, had that contradictory force of the sublime, where everything's awesome and scary and yet enjoyable, in the sense one could, you know, see the beauty in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that in fact did lead me to the next series of photographs, where I photographed just the smoke, and that was all around here in Buffalo. I noticed that when I was driving around in the winter, here's the winter thing, the smoke from the Bethlehem Steel or Goodyear plant in Niagara Falls that just hung heavy in the air, and it was really, really beautiful, and especially at the time of around sunset. And so I made these photographs of the smoke billowing and just showing one little smokestack, so just to give it some kind of meaning. But those were really very much connected to the sublime, I thought.
Even an industrial sublime.
Yes, right. Yeah, I don't think people didn't have the same problems with those pictures for some reason.
So people weren't asking you about the political implications of those as much as the...
No, the power plants. I guess it was the time the time that those came out. You know,
which was about when?
In the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people were more able to read the Smoke series as a commentary on environmental impact rather than the more landscapes with
uh-huh.
the power plants?
I think they were more, yeah, I think they got what I was looking for, that they saw them as, you know, beautiful pictures and yet were able to enjoy the dissonance from the meaning of the picture.
And did you view them as a form of protest? Yeah.
No. I actually don't think photography is art photography.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good form of protest. And, you know, if I want, and I do, you know, make contributions to all the environmental organizations, but that's not what my work is about. You know, I was just burned by the some of the responses to the power plant pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So that was purely about the sublime. And the next, I think the next series was photographing the Niagara Falls with a telephoto lens. So I was able to go even further out on that sublime limb and make pictures that were both scary and beautiful. Yeah.
And I have to ask, did you do a photo of maybe Hooker Chemical and
together with
the
falls?
Yeah. Maybe it was accidental.
No. All that series, actually, there was one in between where I was commissioned by the Castellani Museum in Niagara Falls to do a book on the Niagara River, reflecting the art of Amos Sangster, who was the 19th century artist who walked up and down the river and did beautiful river drawings. So that came first, and then I did the pictures of just the water.
The mist, in some ways, is very similar to the smoke you would see from maybe the towers.
The mist, you know, was some of the pictures I have a lot of mist in, and it does look like smoke
mm-hmm.
in a way. But no, so those were those two series were quite related
mm-hmm.
to each other.
After the Niagara Falls series,
uh-huh.
and is there a title for that series?
Niagara Sublime.
Ah, Niagara Sublime.
Right.
Yeah. Where did you go from there?
Then I had, how should I put this? My life was derailed by a bout with cancer. So
mm-hmm.
I had to fight cancer, and it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But it led to an experience that was probably the ultimate in cancer cures, which is a bone marrow transplant at the Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester. And so I was in a sterile environment for 28 days, where they replaced my bone marrow with actually bone marrow that I had saved and banked before this all happened. And I decided that I would take pictures nevertheless, that if I was really a photographer, that I could take pictures under any circumstances. And so I didn't have very much in my room except the window. And the window didn't look at anything interesting, just another building. But some of my variables were the blinds on the window and the weather and time of day type of thing. So I was did a series, just fairly abstract series that really didn't, it was sort of a very neutral type of picture, which didn't say anything about my situation whatsoever. But the meaning of the entire project became obvious when I titled it, and the title was "The View of the Burn Treatment Center from the Bone Marrow Transplant Unit During the Russian Revolution." And so I put a lot of stuff in the title, but the that was exactly the time when Russia broke apart. So it was, everything was going on at once, and I made these very simple abstract pictures, and people really respond to that series. They really do. So it seems to have worked. I just wanted to say that the bone marrow transplantation worked, and we're sitting here 20 years later, and everything's still fine.
That's incredible and wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question about maybe those very simple abstract pictures with a very detailed title to the series? Do you find that's part of that the context you provide in text, but that lacks in the visuals, add something? Or do you think it's just really the aesthetics of the images are what people respond to?
I'm a firm believer in having titles to pictures, and it's very difficult for me to both have a overall title, which because you're really coloring the way people look at the work. And also individual titles. Well, individual titles usually are the place, and those are a lot easier to do. Or, you know, like Goodyear number 1 and Bethlehem number 23. But the overall title, I think it's very important for an artist to put on their work. Because it's, you know, it does give a clue, especially in the abstract work, except a lot of people put titles of where they were when they were painting this abstract painting or whatever. So, you know, "Eat Your Heart Out." I was in Cape Cod, Cape Cod number 1, Cape Cod number 5. But I find it very hard to do a title, but then when I finally done it, figured it out, then that's good. And it certainly does color it well.
Thank you. So that was maybe if it was during the fall of the Iron Curtain, that was the early 90s when all of that happened.
91, yeah. 91. My transplant was 93.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. 93, and now we're in 2013.
Yeah. Where did you move on to from there?
Pardon?
Is there, you know, we don't have to go through maybe every series you've ever worked on, but are there any other notable series that
let's see,
that you either really enjoyed or you found very influential to your career? Or,
well, then I started working more digitally.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I didn't want to imitate my analog photography with the digital camera, so I just used, in fact, I haven't really used a digital camera for any of my photography yet. I've always, in the last 12 years, I've probably done what one calls a hybrid, where I started out with negatives or slides that I had done before, and digitalize them. And so I never had a digital camera that I was good enough to use for making the larger images that I desired. And so the other photograph here in the collection was from a series called The Scrolls, The Scroll series. And those are very elongated photographs, which are the result of making a mistake while I was scanning the photograph with the negatives. And I typed in the numbers backwards. And I wound up suddenly with a photograph that was, you know, four times as high as it should be. And I loved the result and the, you know, idea that I could make mountains out of molehills in a way that, because everything is so flat around Buffalo, and but I was able to use that defect or the mistake and make photographs that looked like they, some of them actually looked like they were made in China, even though they were made in northern Pennsylvania. So the one here that is in your collection is something I did in the Adirondacks, and it is a moonrise, and it's reflection on a little lake. So it's has a lot of I guess symbolism to it. And those were, I'm trying to think of what else I can say about them, but it was, you know, definitely influenced by Asian art, and the way I framed it was in reference to Asian art, where I even had sort of a reddish wood frame. I should have put a little ideogram stamp on it, mm-hmm. but I didn't. I wasn't going to go that far.
Yeah. And even the way the matting is,
the
When was that series that you started working on?
2008, mm-hmm. something like that. Well, pretty recent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So generally, I like to work with mistakes I make on the computer. And another mistake I made in the computer was to, well, actually it wasn't a mistake, but I discovered the Liquify tool, and became very enamored of the possibilities there, sort of using it as a finger painting. I'm looking at Charlie Clough's painting right now. But the Liquify tools allows you to make the photograph look as if it's sort of, how should I put it, underwater or whatever. And I had this series of lava pictures that I had made in Hawaii a few years ago. And just 4x5 pictures of the lava rocks, you know, looking very dark. But I had this idea that I would reliquify the lava, which had hardened on the slopes of the volcano, and continue it. And that led to, then I was able to use a lot of geology pictures that I had also made throughout the West, speaking of Western color. As I was going around the West with looking for these power places and places to do my altered landscapes, I was always, I came upon a lot of places where I had absolutely no clue as to what I was going to do with it, but I had to take the picture because the geology out there is so outstanding, and the colors. And so these basically were texture pictures, no sky or anything, just flat texture pictures. And so I finally figured out a way to use those from the past, and I began to liquefy them. And as I was studying the geology of the region, I realized that a lot of the landscape had been created by water in prehistoric times, and that a lot of the things that I found so interesting were just layers of sandstone and different materials and that made the different colors. And so it became my investigation of geology. And I went to, for example, to Yellowstone Park and photographed some of the geology there. But I had a really hard time figuring out what I could call this series. But in one of the books that I was reading on geology, it mentioned one of the first books on geology, which was a French book. And so I decided to call the series Metamorphose de la Terre, which I thought was just perfect. And it was not, it sounds better in French than it does in English. So.
The Metamorphosis of the Earth.
Right. So that was one that I had to work. I mean, since I do so many series, that I have to have a title for each one. So that, I think that's the last one. Oh, the last one I am just working on now, and we'll have a show this winter, is I've again researching my slides and transparencies that I did a long time ago that I hadn't printed and worked with, and I found that I had a lot of negatives of places that looked like I might have done. They were altered landscapes, but they weren't altered by me. They were altered by other people, so that they were sort of humorous pictures of things I found along the way. That series is called Beauty, Humor, Nature, Knowledge, because of I found a sign made out of sticks along the side of a highway in Florida, and it said Beauty, Humor, Nature, Knowledge. And so that was a big summing up of my life and work and art. And so I used that title.
It seems that so much of your work focuses on the different landscapes available within the United States.
Uh-huh.
In that way, have you ever identified or conceptualized your work with sort of this Americana or this American lens that you've created?
Well, I did go to England and did a series there, and England and Wales. So some of the ideas about the American landscape, actually how one looks at it, the early American artists, also, you know, some of the ideas of the picturesque came directly from England. So that was one way. So, no, I don't think so, because a lot of the, you know, desert landscapes tend to look the same in Australia and wherever. The moon.
Yeah.
the Mars.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't. So identify myself as an American landscape photographer.
Good. Good.
Okay.
To know. How many years would you say that you have been pursuing a career as a fine art photographer?
Since 1972.
41 years.
40 years. Is that
41 years?
Yeah.
In the 41 years. And the many different series that you've created. Looking back now, would you say that you've seen any specific impacts that you can pinpoint because of your work?
Well, I don't see it. I actually, last week I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I gave a talk at the Society of Photographic Education Regional Conference. And a lot of people cited me as an example of why they wanted to go into photography. So I thought that was sweet. I thought that was nice. I don't know how much I influenced them, but I don't know. I like to think that my work opens certain doors to people, that in terms of giving them a different way of looking at the landscape, that the landscape could mean so much more than just the trees and rocks in front of the camera. Yeah.
Also, what's your relationship with interpretations of your work? I mean, theoretical interpretations of your work. For example, even just talking with you today, I'm learning more about themes of the environment, but also themes of health that are kind of coming through in both personal health as well as the way the environment impacts our health. And while also talking with you, I'm getting the impression that, you know, the political side really wasn't your focus or even anything that impacted you. But I'm seeing these themes that could be theorized in other ways. And maybe it's just a question I like asking artists, you know, because especially with writers, you know, that people come to them and say, well, what about this theme in your book? And a writer will say, well, I never intended to have that
right.
there, you know, but it inspires theses. And perhaps, can I ask, can you look back at your own work and see themes there that you did not intend when you created them?
I don't know. You know, like one, it seemed like one project led into the next, and I just went with the flow and didn't think too much about it. One person in this audience in Lincoln, Nebraska, was sort of questioning, sort of the same type of question, that did I conceptualize the work before I went out and did it, and that I had things I wanted to say with my photography. And I told him that all of my work comes from things that I have seen, that I don't go out saying I want to do, that my next project is going to be about the, you know, dirty water or whatever. But I do, as I drive around for doing all these different things, I see things and some of them spark a new direction or a new series. And so it's all based on the eye, and then afterwards I put this, you know, the title on, and it's the Metamorphosis title or whatever, so that it just seems a much more natural way of working.
And the concept comes after you've
right.
already got the body of
well,
work.
Well, see, I do so many different false starts too, and you don't see those, and some of them never pan out, or some of them I take up later and when I have a better idea of what I'm doing. So it's not something that I dictate to my camera that it should do for me. It dictates to me what it sees.
And I think that's something that perhaps even photographers specifically have a closer relationship to, because though you are deciding both where to shoot and
mm.
how to develop that. You know, it's not an interpretation the way a painting or a work of literature is.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the photographer as lens, as well as the lens the photographer uses.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you can work photographically. You know, some people work photographically that way, as a painter would or whatever. Especially now with digital, you can do that easily. But I just love the way the world looks. You know, I want to be able to respond to that and to use that in my work. And that's one reason that all my work is in focus. There was a time, maybe 10 years ago, where everybody was working out of focus and doing these sort of, I don't know, the whole thing was
impressionistic,
right. And I just want people to recognize the scene and be able to experience the scene and place themselves into it.
So, you know, let me know how you feel about answering this, but, you know, now that you've been in the field of fine art photography for over 40 years, if you could go back and give yourself advice at the beginning of your career, can you think of anything you might tell yourself?
Be nice to people. Because it's, I think in all the arts, in the arts as a career, it's very important to have connections and to make connections with other artists. Some of those connections will influence your work. So, I probably should have made a lot more connections. But they didn't have Facebook then, so. Yeah, that's it.
Well, John, is there anything else you'd like to say today?
No, it's okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in and doing an interview with us here at the Birchfield Penny Art Center.
Thank you.